Takuan says Musashi's appointment has been cancelled. They seem to have doubts about his character. I don't think we should let Otsu go on to Edo without telling her.
I'll go.
No, I'll go myself. With a nod to Ushinosuke, Hyogo left the dojo and went directly to the stable. He was halfway to Uji when he began to have second thoughts. Musashi's not receiving the appointment would make no difference to Otsu. She was thinking of the man himself, not his status. Even if Hyogo managed to persuade her to stay a while longer in Koyagyu, she would no doubt want to go on to Edo. Why spoil her journey by telling her the bad news? He turned back toward Koyagyu and slowed down to a trot. Though he appeared to be at peace with the world, a fierce battle raged in his heart. If only he could see Otsu once more. While he had to admit to himself this was the real reason for going after her, he would not have admitted it to anyone else. Hyogo tried to rein in his emotions. Warriors had weak moments, foolish moments, like everybody else. Still, his duty, that of every samurai, was clear. To persevere until he reached a state of stoic balance. Once he had crossed the barrier of illusion, his soul would be light and free, his eyes open to the green willows around him, to every blade of grass. Love was not the only emotion capable of firing a samurai's heart. His was another world. In an age hungry for young men of talent, this was no time to be distracted by a flower along the wayside. What was important, as Hyogo saw it, was to be in the right place to ride the wave of the times.
"Quite a crowd, isn't it?"
Hyogo remarked lightheartedly.
"Yes. Nara doesn't have many days as fine as this," replied Skekuro.
"It's like an outing."
Following a few steps behind them was Ushinosuke, for whom Hyogo was developing quite a fondness. The boy came to the castle more frequently now and was on his way to becoming a regular attendant. He carried their lunches on his back and had an extra pair of sandals for Hyogo tied to his obi. They were in an open field in the middle of town. On one side, the five-story pagoda of the Kofukuji rose above the surrounding woods. Visible across the field were the houses of the Buddhist and Shinto priests. Though the day was bright and the air spring-like, a thin mist hung over the lower areas where townsmen lived. The crowd, numbering between 400 and 500 people, did not seem that large because of the vastness of the field. Some of the deer, for which Nara was famous, were nosing their way among the spectators, sniffing out tasty morsels of food here and there.
"They haven't finished already, have they?"
asked Hyogo.
"No," said Skekuro. "They seem to be taking time off for lunch."
"So even priests have to eat,"
Skekuro laughed. The occasion was a show of sorts. The larger cities had theaters, but in Nara and the smaller towns, shows were held in the open air. Magicians, dancers, puppeteers, as well as archers and swordsmen, all performed outdoors. Today's attraction was more than mere entertainment, though. Each year, the lancer priests of the Hozoin held a tournament, at which they decided the order of seating at the temple. Since they were performing in public, the competitors fought hard, and the bouts were often violent and spectacular. There was a sign in front of the Kofukuji, clearly stating that the tournament was open to all who were devoted to the martial arts, but the outsiders who dared face the lancer priests were very, very few.
"Why don't we sit down somewhere and have our lunch?" said Hyogo. "We seem to have plenty of time."
"Where would be a good spot?" said Skekuro, looking around.
"Over here," called Ushinosuke. "You can sit on this."
He indicated a piece of reed matting he had picked up somewhere and spread on a pleasant knoll.
Hyogo admired the boy's resourcefulness and, in general, was pleased by the way his needs were looked after, although he did not regard solicitous as an ideal quality for a future samurai. After they had arranged themselves, Ushinosuke passed out their simple fare, balls of unpolished rice, sour plum pickles, and Swedish bean paste, all wrapped in dried bamboo to make them easier to carry.
Ushinosuke, said Tsukekuro, run over to those priests there and get some tea, but don't tell them who it's for.
It would be a nuisance if they came over to pay their respects, added Hyogo, who had a basket hat pulled down over his face.
Skikuro's features were more than half hidden by a bandana of the type worn by priests. As Ushinosuke got to his feet, another boy, about 15 feet away, was saying, I can't understand it. The matting was right here.
Forget it, Iori, said Gonnosuke. It's no great loss.
Somebody must have swiped it. Who do you suppose would do a thing like that?
Don't worry about it.
Gonnosuke sat down on the grass, took out his brush and ink, and began listing his expenses in a small notebook, a habit he had recently acquired from Iori. In some ways, Iori was too serious for his years. He paid close attention to his personal finances, never wasted a thing, was meticulously neat, and felt grateful for every bowl of rice every fair day. He was, in short, fastidious, and he looked down on people who were not. For anyone who'd walk off with another person's property, even if it was only a cheap piece of matting, he had only contempt.
"Oh, there it is!" he cried. "Those men over there took it! Hey, you!"
He ran toward them, but stopped about 10 paces short to consider what he was going to say, and found himself face to face with Ushinosuke.
"What do you want?"
growled Ushinosuke.
"What do you mean, what do I want?"
snapped Iori. Regarding him with the coldness country folk reserve for outsiders, Ushinosuke said,
"You're the one who called to us!
Anybody who goes off with somebody else's things is a thief!"
"Thief? Why, you son of a bitch! That matting belongs to us!"
"Matting? I found it lying on the ground. Is that all you're upset about?"
A mat's important to a traveler, said Iori rather pompously. It protects him from the rain, provides him with something to sleep on. Lots of things. Give it back.
You can have it, but first take back what you said about me being a thief.
I don't have to apologize to get back what belongs to us. If you don't give it back, I'll take it back.
Just try it. I'm Ushinosuke of Araki. I have no intention of losing to a runt like you. I'm the disciple of a samurai.
I bet you are, said Iori, standing a little straighter. You talk big with all these people around, but you wouldn't dare fight if we were by ourselves.
I won't forget that.
Come over there later.
Where?
By the pagoda. Come alone.
They parted. Ushinosuke went for the tea, and by the time he came back with an earthenware teapot, the matches were underway again. Standing in a large circle with the other spectators, Ushinosuke looked pointedly at Iori, challenging him with his eyes. Iori's eyes answered. Both believed that winning was all that counted. The noisy crowd pushed this way and that, raising yellow clouds of dust. In the center of the circle stood a priest with a lance as long as a fowling pole. One after another, rivals stepped forward and challenged him. One after another, they were struck to the ground or sent flying through the air.
"Come forward," he cried, but eventually no more came. "If there's no one else, I'm going to leave. Is there any objection to declaring me, Nunkobo, the winner?"
After studying under Inye, he had created a style of his own and was now the chief rival of Inshun, who was absent today on the pretext of illness. No one knew whether he was afraid of Nankobo or preferred to avoid conflict. When no one came forward, the burly priest lowered his lance, holding it horizontally, and announced,
"There's no challenger!"
"Wait!"
called the priest, running out in front of Nankobo.
"I'm Daun, a disciple of Inshun. I challenge you!"
"Get ready!"
After bowing to each other,
The two men jumped apart. Their two lances stared at each other like living beings for such a long time that the crowd, bored, began shouting for action. Then, all at once, the shouting ceased. Nankobo's lance thudded into Daun's head, and, like a scarecrow toppled by the wind, his body leaned slowly to the side, then fell suddenly to the ground. Three or four lancers ran forward, not to take revenge, but merely to drag the body away. Nankobo arrogantly threw back his shoulders and surveyed the crowd. "There seem to be a few brave men left. If indeed there are, come ahead." A mountain priest stepped out from behind a tent, took his traveling chest off his back, and asked, "Is the tournament open only to lancers of the Hozoin?" "No," chorused the Hozoin priests. The priest bowed. "In that case, I'd like to try my hand. Can anyone lend me a wooden sword?" Hyogo glanced at Skikuro and said, "This is getting interesting."
"It is, isn't it?"
"No question about the outcome."
"I don't suppose there's any chance of Nankobo losing."
"That's not what I meant. I don't think Nankobo will agree to fight. If he does, he'll lose."
Skikuro looked puzzled, but didn't ask for an explanation. Someone handed the vagabond priest a wooden sword. He walked up to Nankobo, bowed, and issued his challenge. He was a man of about 40, but his body, like spring steel, strongly suggested training not in the ascetic fashion of mountain priests, but on the battlefield, a man who must have faced death many times and would be prepared to accept it philosophically. His manner of speaking was soft, his eyes placid. Despite his arrogance, Nankobo was no fool.
"Are you an outsider?"
he asked pointlessly.
"Yes,"
replied the challenger with another bow.
"Wait just a minute."
Nankobo saw two things clearly. His technique might be better than the priest's. He couldn't win in the long run. Quite a few celebrated warriors, defeated at Sekigahara, were still masquerading as wandering priests. There was no telling who this man was.
"I can't take on an outsider," he said, shaking his head.
"I just asked the rules and was told it was all right."
"It may be all right with others, but I prefer not to fight outsiders. When I fight, it's not for the purpose of defeating my opponent. It's a religious activity in which I discipline my soul by means of the lance."
"I see,"
said the priest with a little laugh. He seemed to have something more to say, but hesitated. After mulling it over for a moment, he retired from the ring, returned the wooden sword, and disappeared. Nankobo chose this time to make his exit, ignoring the whispered comments that it was cowardly of him to back out. Trailed by two or three disciples, he strode away grandly, like a conquering general.
"What did I tell you?"
said Hyogo.
"You were absolutely right."
"That man is without a doubt one of those hiding out on Mount Kudo. Change his white robe and bandana for a helmet and armor, and you'll find you're looking at one of the great swordsmen of a few years ago."
When the crowd thinned out, Skikuro began looking around for Ushinosuke. He didn't find him. At a signal from Iori, he had gone over to the pagoda, where now they stood glaring fiercely at each other.
"Don't blame me if you get killed," said Iori.
"You talk big,"
said Ushinosuke, picking up a stick to use as a weapon. Iori, sword held high, rushed to the attack. Ushinosuke jumped back. Thinking he was afraid, Iori ran straight at him. Ushinosuke leaped over him, kicking him in the side of the head. Iori's hand went to his head, and he crashed to the ground. Recovering quickly, he was on his feet again in no time. The two boys faced each other with their weapons raised. Forgetting what Musashi and Gonnosuke had taught him, Iori charged with his eyes shut. Ushinosuke moved slightly to one side and knocked him down with his stick. Iori lay on his stomach, moaning, sword still in hand.
"Ah! I won!"
shouted Ushinosuke. Then, noticing that Iori was not moving at all, he grew frightened and ran.
"No, you don't!"
roared Gonnosuke, his four-foot staff catching the boy on the hip. Ushinosuke fell with a shriek of pain, but after one look at Gonnosuke, he got to his feet and bounded off like a rabbit, only to collide head-on with Sekikuro.
Ushinosuke, what's going on here?
Ushinosuke quickly hid behind Sekikuro, leaving the samurai face-to-face with Gonnosuke. For a moment, it appeared that a clash was inevitable. Sekikuro's hand went to his sword. Gonnosuke tightened his grip on the staff.
"Would you mind telling me," said Sekikuro, "why you're chasing a mere child as though you wanted to kill him?"
"Before I answer, let me ask a question. Did you see him knock that boy down?"
"Is he with you?"
"Yes. Is this one of your attendants?"
"Not officially."
Looking sternly at Ushinosuke, he said,
"Why did you hit the boy and run away? Tell the truth now."
Before Ushinosuke could open his mouth, Iori raised his head and shouted,
"It was a bout!"
Rising painfully to a sitting position, he said,
"We had a bout, and I lost."
"Did you two challenge each other in the proper way and agreed to fight it out?"
asked Gonnosuke. There was a trace of amusement in his eyes as he looked from one to the other. Ushinosuke, deeply embarrassed, said,
"I didn't know it was his mat when I picked it up."
The two men grinned at each other, both aware that if they had not acted with restraint themselves, a trivial, childish affair could have ended in bloodshed.
"I'm very sorry about this," said Sekikuro.
"So am I. I hope you'll forgive me."
"Don't mention it. My master's waiting for us, so I think we'd better go."
They went out the gate laughing, Gonnosuke and Iori going to the left, Sekikuro and Ushinosuke to the right. Then Gonnosuke turned and said,
"Could I ask you something? If we go straight down this road, will it take us to Koyagyu Castle?"
Sekikuro walked over to Gonnosuke and some minutes later, when Hyogo joined them, told him who the travelers were and why they were here. Hyogo sighed sympathetically.
"That's too bad. If only you'd come 3 weeks ago, before Otsu left to join Musashi in Edo."
"He's not in Edo," said Gonnosuke. "No one knows where he is, not even his friends."
"What'll she do now?"
said Hyogo, regretting he hadn't brought Otsu back to Koyagyu. Though he held back his tears, Iori really wanted to go somewhere all alone and cry his heart out. On the way down, he'd talked incessantly of meeting Otsu, or so it had seemed to Gonnosuke. As the men's conversation shifted to events in Edo, he slowly drifted away. Hyogo asked Gonnosuke for more information about Musashi, for news about his uncle, for details about the disappearance of Ono Tadaaki. There seemed to be no end either to his questions or to Gonnosuke's supply of information.
"Where are you going?"
Ushinosuke asked Iori, coming up behind him and laying a sympathetic hand on his shoulder.
"Are you crying?"
"Of course not."
But as he shook his head, the tears flew.
Do you know how to dig wild potatoes?"
"Sure."
"There are some potatoes over there. You want to see who can dig the fastest?"
Iori accepted the challenge, and they began digging. It was getting late in the day, and since there was still much to talk about, Hyogo urged Gonnosuke to spend a few days at the castle. Gonnosuke, however, said he preferred to continue his journey. While they were saying their farewells, they noticed the boys were missing again. After a moment, Sekikuro pointed and said,
"There they are over there. They seem to be digging."
Iori and Ushinosuke were absorbed in their work, which, because of the brittleness of the roots, involved digging carefully to a great depth. The men, amused at their concentration, walked quietly up behind them and watched for several minutes before Ushinosuke looked up and saw them. He gasped slightly, and Iori turned around and grinned. Then they redoubled their efforts.
"I've got it!"
cried Ushinosuke, pulling up a long potato and laying it on the ground. Seeing Iori's arm sunk in the hole up to his shoulder, Gonnosuke said impatiently,
"If you don't finish soon, I'm going on by myself."
Placing his hand on his hip like an aged farmer, Iori forced himself to a standing position and said,
"I can't do it. It'll take me the rest of the day."
With a look of resignation, he brushed the dirt off his kimono.
You can't get the potato out after you've dug that far?
Asked Ushinosuke.
Here, I'll pull it out for you.
No, said Iori, pulling back Ushinosuke's hand. It'll break. He gently pushed the dirt back in the hole and packed it down.
Bye,
called Ushinosuke, proudly shouldering his potato and accidentally revealing that the tip was broken off. Seeing that, Hyogo said,
You lost. You may have won the fight, but you're disqualified from the potato digging contest.
Sweepers and Salesmen. The cherry blossoms were pale, past their prime, and the thistle blossoms were wilting, hinting nostalgically of the time centuries ago when Nara had been the capital. It was a little warm for walking, but neither Gonnosuke nor Iori tired of the road. Iori tugged at Gonnosuke's sleeve and said worriedly,
That man's still following us.
Keeping his eyes straight ahead, Gonnosuke said,
Pretend you don't see him.
He's been behind us ever since we left the Kofukuji. And he was at the inn where we stayed, wasn't he?
Don't let it worry you. We don't have anything worth stealing.
We have our lives. They're not nothing.
I keep my life locked up. Don't you?
I can take care of myself.
Iori tightened the grip of his left hand on his scabbard.
Gonnosuke knew the man was the mountain priest who had challenged Nankobo the previous day, but couldn't imagine why he'd be tailing them.
Iori looked around again and said, He's not there anymore.
Gonnosuke looked back, too.
He probably got tired.
He took a deep breath and added,
But it does make me feel better.
They put up at a farmer's house that night and early the next morning reached Amano in Kawachi. This was a small village of low-eaved houses, behind which ran a stream of pristine mountain water. Gonnosuke had come to have the memorial tablet to his mother placed in the Kongoji, the so-called Women's Mount Koya. But first, he wanted to look up a woman named Oang, whom he had known since childhood, so there would be someone to burn incense before the tablet from time to time. If she could not be found, he intended to go on to Mount Koya, the burial place of the rich and the mighty. He hoped he wouldn't have to. Going there would make him feel like a beggar. Asking directions from a shopkeeper's wife, he was told that Oan was the wife of a brewer named Toroku, and their house was the fourth one on the right inside the temple gate. As he went through the gate, Gonnosuke wondered if the woman knew what she was talking about, for there was a sign saying that bringing sake and leeks into the sacred compound was prohibited. How could there be a brewery there? This little mystery was cleared up that evening by Toroku, who had made them feel welcome and readily agreed to talk to the abbot about the memorial tablet. Toroku said that Toyotomi Hideyoshi had once tasted and expressed admiration for the sake made for use by the temple. The priests had then established the brewery to make sake for Hideyoshi and the other daimyo who contributed to the temple's support. Production had fallen off somewhat after Hideyoshi's death, but the temple still supplied a number of special patrons. When Gonnosuke and Iori awoke the next morning, Toroku was already gone. He returned a little past noon and said that arrangements had been made. The Kongoji was situated in the Amano River Valley, amid peaks the color of jade. Gonnosuke, Iori, and Toroku stopped for a minute on the bridge leading to the main gate. Cherry blossoms floated in the water beneath the bridge. Gonnosuke straightened his shoulders, and an air of reverence seemed to settle over him. Iori rearranged his collar. Approaching the main hall, they were greeted by the abbot, a tall, rather stout man wearing an ordinary priest's robe. A torn basket hat and a long staff would not have seemed unnatural.
"Is this the man who wants to have a service said for his mother?" he asked in a friendly voice.
"Yes, sir,"
replied Toroku, prostrating himself on the ground. Having expected a stern-visaged cleric in gold brocade, Gonnosuke was somewhat confused in his greeting.
He bowed and watched as the abbot came down from the porch, slipped his big feet into dirty straw sandals, and came to a halt in front of him. Prayer beads in hand, the abbot directed them to follow him, and a young priest fell in behind them. They passed the hall of Yakshi, the refectory, the one-story treasure pagoda, and the priest's living quarters. When they reached the hall of Dainichi, the young priest came forward and spoke to the abbot. The latter nodded, and the priest opened the door with an enormous key. Entering the large hall together, Gonnosuke and Iori knelt before the priest's dais. Fully 10 feet above this was a huge golden statue of Dainichi, the universal Buddha of the esoteric sects. After a few moments, the abbot appeared from behind the altar, attired in his cassock, and arranged himself on the dais. The chanting of the sutra began, and he seemed to be subtly transformed into a dignified high priest, his authority evident in the set of his shoulders. Gonnosuke clasped his hands in front of him. A small cloud seemed to pass before his eyes, and from it emerged an image of Shiojiri Pass, where he and Musashi had tested each other. His mother was sitting to one side, straight as a board, looking worried, just as she had been when she called out the word that saved him in that fight.
"Mother," he thought, "you don't have to worry about my future. Musashi has consented to be my teacher. The day is not far off when I'll be able to establish my own school. The world may be in turmoil, but I won't stray from the way, nor will I neglect my duties as a son."
By the time Gonnosuke came out of his reverie, the chanting had stopped and the abbot was gone. Beside him, Iori sat transfixed, his eyes glued to the face of Dainichi, a miracle of sculptural sensitivity carved by the great Unkei in the 13th century.
"Why are you staring so, Iori?"
Without moving his eyes, the boy said,
"It's my sister. That Buddha looks like my sister."
Gonnosuke burst out laughing.
"What are you talking about? You've never even seen her. Anyway, no human could ever have the compassion and serenity of Dainichi."
Iori shook his head vigorously.
"I have seen her, near Lord Yagyu's residence in Edo, and talked to her. I didn't know she was my sister then, but just now, while the abbot was chanting, the Buddha's face turned into hers. She seemed to be saying something to me."
They went out and sat down on the porch, reluctant to break the spell of the visions they had experienced.
"The memorial service was for my mother," said Gonnosuke pensively. "But it's been a good day for the living, too. Sitting here like this, it's hard to believe fighting and bloodshed exist."
The metal spire of the treasure pagoda glistened like a jeweled sword in the rays of the setting sun. All the other buildings stood in deep shadow. Stone lanterns lined the darkened path leading up the steep hill to a Muromachi-style tea house and a small mausoleum. Near the tea house, an old nun, her head covered with a white silk bandana, and a plump man of about 50 were sweeping leaves with straw brooms. The nun sighed and said,
"I guess it's better than it was."
Few people came to this part of the temple, even to clear away the winter's accumulation of leaves and bird skeletons.
"You must be tired, mother," said the man. "Why don't you sit down and rest? I'll finish up."
He was dressed in a simple cotton kimono, sleeveless cloak, straw sandals, and leather socks with a cherry blossom design, and carried a short sword with an unadorned hilt made of sharkskin.
"I'm not tired," she replied with a little laugh. "But what about you? You're not used to this. Aren't your hands chapped?" "No, not chapped, but they're covered with blisters."
The woman laughed again, saying,
"Now, isn't that a nice reminder to take home with you?"
"I don't mind.
I feel my heart's been purified. I hope that means our little offering of labor has pleased the gods. Oh, it's getting so dark. Let's leave the rest for tomorrow morning.
Gonnosuke and Iori were standing by the porch now. Koetsu and Myoshu came down the path slowly, hand in hand. When they got near the Dainichi Hall, both started and cried,
"Who's there?"
Then Myoshu said,
"It's been a lovely day, hasn't it? Have you come for sightseeing?"
Gonnosuke bowed and said,
"No, I've had a sutra read for my mother." "It's nice to meet young people who are grateful to their parents."
She gave Iori a maternal pat on the head.
"Koetsu, do you have any of those wheat cakes left?"
Taking a small package from his sleeve, Koetsu offered it to Iori, saying,
"Forgive me for offering you leftovers."
"Gonnosuke, may I accept it?"
asked Iori.
"Yes,"
said Gonnosuke, thanking Koetsu on Iori's behalf.
"From the way you talk, you seem to be from the east," said Myoshu. "May I ask where you're going?" "It seems to be on an endless journey on a never-ending road. This boy and I are fellow disciples in the way of the sword."
"It's an arduous path you've chosen. Who is your teacher?"
"His name is Miyamoto Musashi."
"Musashi? You don't say!"
Myoshu gazed into space, as though conjuring up a pleasant memory.
"Where is Musashi now?" asked Koetsu. "It's been a long time since last we saw him."
Gonnosuke told them of Musashi's fortunes during the past couple of years. As he listened, Koetsu nodded and smiled, as if to say,
"That's what I'd expect of him."
When he finished, Gonnosuke asked,
"May I inquire who you are?" "Oh, forgive me for not telling you before."
Koetsu introduced himself and his mother.
"Musashi stayed with us for a while, several years ago. We're very fond of him and often talk about him even now."
He then told Gonnosuke about two or three incidents that had occurred when Musashi was in Kyoto. Gonnosuke had long known of Koetsu's reputation as a sword polisher, and more recently he had heard of Musashi's relationship with the man. But he'd never expected to run into this wealthy townsman tidying up neglected temple grounds.
"Is there a grave of someone close to you here?"
he asked.
"Or perhaps you've come for an outing?" "No, nothing so frivolous as an outing," exclaimed Koetsu. "Not in a holy place like this. Have you heard from the priests something of the history of the Kongoji?"
"No."
"In that case, allow me, in the priest's stead, to tell you a little about it. Please understand, however, that I'm merely repeating what I've heard."
Koetsu paused and looked around slowly, then said,
"We have just the right moon tonight,"
and pointed out the landmarks. Above them, the mausoleum, Miedo, and Kangetsute. Below, the Taishido, Shinto Shrine, Treasure Pagoda, Refectory, and Two-Story Gate.
"Look carefully," he said,
seemingly under the spell of the lonely setting.
"That pine tree, those rocks, every tree, every blade of grass here, partake of the invisible constancy, the elegant tradition of our country."
He went on in this vein, solemnly telling how in the 14th century, during a conflict between southern and northern courts, the mountain had been a stronghold of the southern court. How Prince Morinaga, known also as Daito no Miya, had held secret conferences to plan the overthrow of the Hojo regents. How Kusunoki Masashige and other loyalists had fought the armies of the northern court. Later, the Ashikagas had come to power, and Emperor Go Murakami, driven from Mount Otoko, had been forced to flee from place to place. Finally, he took refuge at the temple and for many years lived the same sort of life as the mountain priests, suffering the same deprivations. Using the refectory as his seat of government, he had worked tirelessly to recover the imperial prerogatives seized by the military. At an earlier time, when samurai and courtiers had gathered around the ex-emperors Kogong, Komyo, and Sko, the monk Zenge had written poignantly, "The priests' quarters and mountain temples were all swept away. The loss is indescribable." Gonosuke listened humbly, respectfully. Iori, awed by the gravity of Koetsu's voice, could not take his eyes from the man's face. Koetsu took a deep breath and went on.
"Everything here is a relic of that age. The mausoleum is the last resting place of the Emperor Kogong. Since the decline of the Ashikagas, nothing's been properly taken care of. That's why my mother and I decided to do a little cleaning up as a gesture of reverence."
Pleased by the attentiveness of his audience, Koetsu searched diligently for words to express his heartfelt emotions.
"While we were sweeping, we found a stone with a poem carved on it, perhaps by a soldier priest of that age. It said, 'Though the war goes on, even for 100 years, spring will return. Live with a song in your hearts, you, the Emperor's people.' Think of the bravery, the largeness of spirit it took for a simple soldier, after fighting for years, perhaps decades, to protect the Emperor, to be able to rejoice and sing. I'm sure it's because the spirit of Masashige communicated itself to him. Though 100 years of fighting have passed, this place remains a monument to the imperial dignity. Isn't this something for which we should be very grateful?"
"I didn't know this was the site of a sacred battle," said Gonosuke. "I hope you'll forgive my ignorance."
"I'm glad I had a chance to share with you some of my thoughts on the history of our country."
The four of them strolled down the hill together. In the moonlight, their shadows seemed thin and unsubstantial. As they passed the refectory, Koetsu said,
"We've been here 7 days. We'll be leaving tomorrow. If you see Musashi, please tell him to come see us again."
Gonosuke assured him that he would. The shallow, swift-flowing stream along the outer temple wall was like a natural moat and was crossed by a dirt-floored bridge. Gonosuke and Iori had hardly set foot on the bridge when a large white figure armed with a staff emerged from the shadows and flew at Gonosuke's back. Gonosuke evaded the attack by sliding to one side, but Iori was knocked off the bridge. The man plunged on past Gonosuke to the road on the other side of the bridge. Turning around, he took a solid stance, his legs resembling small tree trunks. Gonosuke saw it was the priest who had been following him the previous day.
"Who are you?"
shouted Gonosuke. The priest said nothing. Gonosuke moved his staff into striking position and shouted,
"Who are you? What reason do you have for attacking Muso Gonosuke?"
The priest acted as if he hadn't heard. His eyes spat fire as his toes, protruding from heavy straw sandals, inched forward like a centipede in motion. Gonosuke growled and cursed under his breath. His short, heavy limbs bursting with the will to fight, he too inched forward. The priest's staff broke in two with a resounding crack. One part flew through the air, the other the priest hurled with all his might at Gonosuke's face. It missed, but while Gonosuke was recovering his balance, his opponent drew his sword and stomped out onto the bridge.
"You bastard!" shouted Iori.
The priest gasped and put his hand to his face. The small stones Iori had thrown had found their mark, one hitting him squarely in the eye. He spun around and ran down the road.
"Stop!"
shouted Iori, scrambling up the bank with a handful of stones.
"Never mind,"
said Gonosuke, putting his hand on Iori's arm.
"I guess that'll show him," gloated Iori.
casting the stones toward the moon. Soon after, they returned to Todoku's house and went to bed. A squall came up. The wind roared through the trees, threatening to tear the roof off the house. But this was not the only thing that kept them from falling asleep right away. Gonosuke lay awake, thinking about past and present, wondering if the world was really better off now that it had been in bygone ages. Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, and Ieyasu had won the hearts of the people, as well as the authority to govern. But, he wondered, hadn't the true sovereign been virtually forgotten, the people led to worship false gods? The age of the Hojos and Ashikagas had been a hateful one, blatantly contradicting the very principle on which the country was founded. Still, even then, great warriors, like Masashige and his son, and loyalists from many provinces had followed the true warrior's code. What had become of the way of the samurai? Gonosuke asked himself. Like the way of the townsmen, and the way of the farmer, it seemed to exist now only for the sake of the military ruler. Gonosuke's thoughts made his body feel warm all over. The peaks of Kawachi, the woods around the Kongoji, the howling storm seemed to become living beings, calling to him in a dream. Iori could not get the unknown priest out of his mind. He was still thinking of the ghostly white figure much later when the storm intensified. He pulled the covers over his eyes and fell into a deep, dreamless sleep. When they set out the next day, the clouds above the mountains were rainbow-colored. Just outside the village, a traveling merchant materialized from the morning mist and wished them a jovial good morning. Gonosuke replied perfunctorily. Iori, absorbed in the thoughts that had kept him awake the night before, was no more talkative. The man tried to strike up a conversation.
"You stayed at Toroku's house last night, didn't you? I've known him for years. Fine people, him and his wife."
This elicited only a mild grunt from Gonosuke.
"I also called at Koyagyu Castle from time to time," said the merchant. "Kimura Sukekuro had done me a lot of favors."
This met with another grunt.
"I see you've been to the women's Mount Koya. I suppose now you'll be going to Mount Koya itself. It's just the right time of the year. The snow's gone and all the roads have been repaired. You can take your time crossing Amami and Kiima passes, spend the night at Hashimoto or Kamuro."
The man's probing about their itinerary made Gonosuke suspicious.
"What business are you in?" he asked.
"I sell braided cord," said the man, pointing to the small bundle on his back. "The cord's made of flat braided cotton. It was only invented recently, but it's getting popular fast."
"I see," said Gonosuke.
"Toroku's helped me a lot, telling worshippers at the Kongoji about my cord. As a matter of fact, I was planning to stay at his house last night, but he said he already had two guests. That was sort of a disappointment. When I stay with him, he always fills me up with good sake," he laughed.
Relaxing a bit, Gonosuke began asking questions about places along the way, for the merchant was quite familiar with the local countryside. By the time they reached Amami Plateau, the conversation had grown fairly friendly.
"Hey, Sugizo!"
A man came trotting along the road to catch up with them.
"Why did you go off and leave me? I was waiting at Amano Village. You said you'd stop by for me." "Sorry, Gensuke," said Sugizo. "I fell in with these two and we got to talking. I forgot all about you."
He laughed and scratched his head. Gensuke, who was dressed like Sugizo, turned out to be a cord salesman too. As they walked, the two merchants fell to discussing business. Coming to a gully about 20 feet deep, Sugizo suddenly stopped talking and pointed.
"Ooh, that's dangerous," he said.
Gonosuke stopped and looked at the gully, which might have been a gap left by an earthquake, perhaps one that happened a very long time ago.
"What seems to be the trouble?" he asked.
"Those logs, they're not safe to cross. See there?
Some of the rocks supporting them have been washed away. We'll fix it so the logs are steady. Then he added, we should do that for the sake of other travelers.
Gonnosuke watched as they squatted at the edge of the cliff and began packing rocks and dirt under the logs. While thinking that these two merchants traveled a great deal and thus knew the difficulties of travel as well as anybody, he was a little surprised. It was unusual for men like them to care enough about others to go to the trouble of repairing a bridge. Iori didn't give the matter any thought. Impressed by their show of concern, he contributed by gathering rocks for them.
That should do it, said Gensuke.
He took a step on the bridge, decided it was safe, and said to Gonnosuke,
I'll go first.
Holding his arms out for balance, he crossed quickly to the other side, then beckoned for the others to follow. At Sugizo's urging, Gonnosuke went next, Iori just behind him. They were not quite to the middle when they let out a shout of surprise. Ahead of them, Gensuke had a lance pointed at them. Gonnosuke looked back and saw Sugizo had also acquired a lance.
Where did the lances come from? Thought Gonnosuke.
He swore, bit his lip angrily, and considered the awkwardness of his position.
Gonnosuke! Gonnosuke!
Taken off guard, Iori clung to Gonnosuke's waist, while Gonnosuke, holding his arm around the boy, shut his eyes for an instant, entrusting his life to the will of heaven.
You bastards! Shut up!
Shouted the priest, who stood higher up on the road, behind Gensuke, his left eye swollen and black.
Keep calm,
Gonnosuke told Iori in a soothing voice. Then he shouted,
So you're behind this! Well, watch out, you thieving bastards! You've tangled with the wrong man this time!
The priest stared coldly at Gonnosuke.
You're not worth robbing. We know that. If you're no smarter than that, what are you doing trying to be a spy? You calling me a spy? Tokugawa dog! Throw that staff away. Put your hands behind your back and don't try anything funny. Ah!
Sighed Gonnosuke, as though the will to fight was deserting him.
Look, you're making a mistake. I did come from Edo, but I'm not a spy. My name is Muso Gonnosuke. I'm a shugyosha. Never mind the lies. What makes you think I'm a spy? Our friends in the East told us some time ago to be on the lookout for a man traveling with a young boy. You were sent down here by Lord Hojo of Awa, weren't you? No. Drop the staff and come along peacefully. I'm not going anywhere with you. Then you'll die right here.
Gensuke and Sugizo began to close in from front and back, lances ready for action. To keep Iori out of harm's way, Gonnosuke slapped him on the back. With a loud shriek, Iori dived into the bushes covering the bottom of the gully. Thundering, Yo! Gonnosuke rushed Sugizo. The lance requires some space and good timing to be effective. Sugizo extended his arm to thrust his weapon forward, but missed the exact moment. A loud croak came from his throat as the blade cut through thin air. Gonnosuke slammed into him, and he fell backward, with Gonnosuke on top of him. When Sugizo attempted to rise, Gonnosuke rammed his right fist into his face. Sugizo bared his teeth, but the effect was ludicrous, for his face was already a bloody mess. Gonnosuke stood up, used Sugizo's head for a springboard, and cleared the distance to the end of the bridge. Staff poised, he shouted,
I'm here waiting, you cowards!
Even as he shouted, three ropes came slithering across the top of the grass, one weighted with a sword guard, another with a short sword in its scabbard. One rope looped around Gonnosuke's arm, another around his legs, and the third around his neck. In a moment, still another rope wound around his staff. Gonnosuke wriggled like an insect caught in a spider web, but not for long. Half a dozen men ran out of the woods behind him. By the time they were finished, he lay helpless on the ground, trussed up tighter than a bundle of straw. With the exception of the surly priest, all his captors were dressed as cord salesmen.
No horses?
Asked the priest,
I don't want to walk him all the way to Mount Kudo.
We can probably hire a horse in Amami Village.
A pear blossom. In the dark, solemn forest of cryptomerias, the voices of the lowly shrike, mingling with those of the celestial bulbul, sounded like the jeweled tones of the mythical Kalavinka bird. Two men coming down from the top of Mount Koya, where they had visited the halls and pagodas of the Kogombuji, and paid their respects at the inner shrine, stopped on a small arched bridge between the inner and outer temple precincts.
"Nuinosuke," said the older man pensively, "the world is indeed fragile and impermanent, isn't it?"
From his heavy homespun cloak and utilitarian hakama, he might have been taken for a country samurai, were it not for his swords, which were of outstanding quality, and the fact that his companion was far too suave and well-groomed for a provincial samurai's attendant.
"You saw them, didn't you?"
he continued.
"The graves of Oda Nobunaga, Akechi Mitsuhide, Ishida Mitsunari, Kobayakawa Kingo, all brilliant, famous generals only a few years ago. And over there, those moss-covered stones mark the burial places of great members of the Minamoto and Taira clans.
Friend and foe, all together here, aren't they?"
"All of them, nothing more than lonely stones. Were names like Uesugi and Takeda really great? Or were we only dreaming?"
"It gives me an odd feeling. Somehow it seems the world we live in is unreal."
"Is it that? Or is it this place that's unreal?"
Who knows?
"Who do you suppose thought of calling this the Bridge of Illusions?"
"It's a well-chosen name, isn't it?"
"I think illusion is truth, just as enlightenment is reality. If illusion were unreal, the world couldn't exist. A samurai who devotes his life to his master cannot, not for an instant, allow himself to be nihilistic. That's why the Zen I practice is living Zen. It's the Zen of the tainted world, the Zen of hell. A samurai who trembles at the thought of impermanence or despises the world cannot perform his duties. Enough of this place. Let's go back to the other world."
He walked quickly with a remarkably firm step for a man of his age. Catching sight of priests from the Seiganji, he frowned and grumbled,
"Why did they have to do that?"
He'd stayed at the temple the night before. Now about 20 young priests were lined up along the pathway, waiting to see him off, though he had said his farewells that morning with the intention of avoiding a display of this sort. He ran the gauntlet, saying polite goodbyes, and hurried on down the road, overlooking the patchwork of valleys known as Kujukutani. Only when he regained the ordinary world did he relax. Conscious as he was of his own fallible human heart, the odor of this world came as relief.
"Hello, who are you?"
The question came at him like a shot as they rounded a bend in the road.
"Who are you?"
asked Nuinosuke. The well-built, light-complexioned samurai standing in the middle of the road said politely,
"Forgive me if I'm mistaken, but aren't you Lord Hosokawa Tadatoshi's senior retainer, Nagaoka Sado?"
"I'm Nagaoka, to be sure. Who are you, and how did you know I was in the vicinity?"
"My name is Daisuke. I'm the only son of Geso, who lives in retirement on Mount Kudo."
Seeing the name did not ring a bell, Daisuke said,
"My father has long since discarded his former name, but until the Battle of Sekigahara, he was known as Sanada Saemon Nosuke."
"Do you mean Sanada Yukimura?"
"Yes, sir."
With a bashfulness seemingly at odds with his appearance, Daisuke said,
A priest from the Seiganji dropped in at my father's house this morning. He said you'd come to Mount Koya for a short visit. Though we heard you were traveling incognito, my father thought it'd be a pity not to invite you to have a cup of tea with him.
That's very kind of him, replied Sado.
He squinted for a minute, then said to Nuinosuke,
I think we ought to accept, don't you?
Yes, sir,
replied Nuinosuke without enthusiasm.
Daisuke said, It's still fairly early in the day, but my father would be honored if you'd spend the night with us.
Sado hesitated a moment, wondering if it was wise to accept the hospitality of a man regarded as an enemy of the Tokugawas, then nodded and said,
We can decide about that later, but I'll be delighted to join your father for a cup of tea. Don't you agree, Nuinosuke?
Yes, sir.
Nuinosuke seemed a bit on edge, but as they started down the road behind Daisuke, master and attendant exchanged knowing glances. From the village of Mount Kudo, they climbed a little farther up the mountain to a residence set apart from the other houses. The enclosure, surrounded by a low stone wall topped by a fence of woven grass, resembled the semi-fortified house of a lesser provincial warlord. But all in all, one got the impression of refinement rather than military preparedness.
My father's over there, by that thatched building, said Daisuke as they went through the gate.
There was a small vegetable garden, sufficient to provide onions and greens for the morning and evening soup. The main house stood in front of a cliff. Near the side veranda was a bamboo grove, beyond which two more houses were just visible. Nuinosuke knelt on the veranda outside the room Sado was shown to. Sado sat down and remarked,
It's very quiet here.
A few minutes later, a young woman who appeared to be Daisuke's wife quietly served tea and left. While Sado waited for his host, he took in the view, the garden and the valley. Below was the village, and in the distance, the inn town of Kamuro. Tiny flowers bloomed on the moss clinging to the overhanging thatched roof, and there was the pleasant fragrance of a rare incense. Though he could not see it, he could hear the stream running through the bamboo grove. The room itself evoked a feeling of quiet elegance, a gentle reminder that the owner of this unpretentious dwelling was the second son of Sanada Masayuki, Lord of Ueda Castle and recipient of an income of 190,000 bushels. The posts and beams were thin, the ceiling low. The wall behind the small, rustic alcove was of roughly finished red clay. The flower arrangement in the alcove consisted of a single sprig of pear blossoms in a slender yellow and light green ceramic vase. Sado thought of Po Chui's solitary pear blossom bathed by the spring rain, and of the love that united the Chinese emperor and young Kuefei, as described in the Chang Heike. He seemed to hear a voiceless sob. His eye moved to the hanging scroll above the flower arrangement. The characters, large and naive, spelled out Hōkoku Daimyōjin, the name Hideyoshi was given when he was elevated to the rank of a god after his death. To one side, a notation in much smaller characters said that this was the work of Hideyoshi's son, Hideyori, at the age of 8. Feeling it discourteous to Hideyoshi's memory to have his back turned to the scroll, Sado shifted a little to the side. As he did so, he realized suddenly that the pleasant smell came not from incense burning right then, but from the walls and shoji, which must have absorbed the fragrance when incense was placed there morning and evening to purify the room in Hideyoshi's honor. Presumably, an offering of sake was also made daily as to established Shinto deities.
Ah, he thought. Yukimura's as devoted to Hideyoshi as they say.
What he could not fathom was why Yukimura did not hide the scroll. He had the reputation of being an unpredictable man, a man of the shadows, lurking and waiting for a propitious moment to return to the center of the country's affairs. It took no stretch of the imagination to